And welcome once again, folks, to All Things Trek here on Trek Radio, 1 p.m. in the West, 4 p.m. in the East. I'm Bob, here with Dave, once again, Pride Engineering, and who are you? What are you?
I don't know. What?
Who are you?
How did I get here?
How did you get here?
This place is kind of confusing, and I'm not entirely certain. I think my name's Oren, and I think I used to be on the show, like, some point in, like, the way distant past, like back when it was just a podcast and not a live show at all. A lot of things seem to have changed since I was gone. I don't remember giving you permission to take this thing to the internet, but here it is. Or to the live internet. All right.
Okay. It's true, folks. Oren's back. Yay.
Yay. I'm not sure if yay is going to be the thing that I've had to greet. I'm not sure if yay is going to be the feeling people are going to greet me with.
Well, we'll see.
All right.
And hi, David.
Yes.
Kapla. Hello.
Hooray.
And again, I've said this off air already, but on air, thank you so much, David, for being there to give us tech while I was gone, because I was biting my nails over that. I wasn't sure what was going to happen. And then suddenly you were there giving us our engineering, so we appreciate that.
Yep, it's happy to help.
All right.
So Oren, yeah. Where have you been?
All right. So for anyone who cares where
it's
I was.
3 weeks.
All right. Well, for the first two weekends, not for the first two entire weeks, but for the first two weekends, which were the ones that mattered, I was in Washington, D.C. And I know everyone's going to ask, why did you go to Washington, D.C.? What could possibly be in Washington, D.C. that would take 9 days? Well, you see, Washington, D.C. has, like, a city ordinance that there has to be a certain number of museums and monuments per square inch. And so...
Are you serious?
No.
Okay, good.
Although I said that...
That'd be a really dumb ordinance.
I said that in Washington, D.C., and someone turned to me and asked, is that true?
Not sure if trolling or just stupid.
So, see, my mom, who really likes museums and stuff, so we went to a whole bunch of those, but we were actually there because a friend of ours works in the White House and offered to get us an actual guided tour, which was really cool. We had the Secret Service agent show us around and tell us everything about everything, and that was a lot of fun.
Did he show you his gun?
He did not. I did not ask.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you know...
That'd be the first thing I'd ask any federal agent.
If you look closely...
Show me your gun.
It was actually kind of funny, because, like, the Secret Service agents are all armed, but they're armed very, you know, subtly. Like, if you look closely, you can kind of see they have a gun under their coat. But then there was this one guy... And I don't know if he was going through the White House on his way to somewhere else, or if his job was to be in the White House, but he was in, like, full camo military gear with a big old assault rifle on his back.
He's ready to rock.
And I was like, I wonder if his job is to just be here with the really big gun. But, you know, because I guess, you know, the White House probably needs one of those.
It's true.
So we did that, and we saw the Air and Space Annex, which is basically, it's the part of the Air and Space Museum where they put all the stuff that's too big to fit in downtown. So it's just this,
it's the warehouse.
Yeah, it's this series of hangars that are full of airplanes and helicopters and a space shuttle. And you don't really get an appreciation for how big the space shuttle is until you're standing next to it. Because it doesn't look that big on TV. But it's just, it's enormous. It is giant. And you're like, they send this thing into space? Or sent, past tense now. But, you know, it's...
Well, there's a big, giant rocket that they strap it to make it happen.
Yeah, right. But, I mean, I'm aware of the mechanics, but it's awe-inspiring is what it is. And there's a lot of really cool-looking fancy planes and stuff. The best ones are the old planes that are, like, you know, really goofy-looking. Like, the ones where they decided that being able to see out the front wasn't actually that important. But, you know...
Excellent.
So those ones are... So, like, that was pretty cool. And then there were, like, a million other museums. Some of them were less cool than others. The Spy Museum, actually really boring.
The what museum?
The Spy Museum.
The Spy Museum.
Yeah, sounds like it would be interesting. Not really. The News Museum, too much building, not enough museum. Like, they have this huge building and not a whole lot of content to fill it with. So there's a lot of walking in between exhibits. And they were playing Stephen Colbert, like, everywhere. And I'm like, okay, guys, I like Stephen Colbert too, all right? But he's not a news show. Maybe he belongs in one exhibit called Farcical News. But he doesn't belong everywhere, and he's just really distracting. But
I find that entertaining, though, that in our nation's capital, that's the thing that's happening.
Yeah, well, because the Colbert Report is popular, and they want people to come to the museum, so they play things that are popular.
That makes sense.
So anyway, so that was cool. And then the third weekend I was gone, I had a booth at Emerald City Comic Con to sell my comics. Two lovely friends of mine came and cosplayed as characters from the comic, which, if anyone's interested, you can find at www.theexiledcomic.com.
Shameless plug.
Yeah, it's kind of shameless. You wanted to know where I was gone.
I knew where you were. These fine people here who have been listening to the sweet nectar that is my voice.
Yeah, they have.
For the past 3 weeks. Didn't hear your voice, though.
It's true. And so, and I was actually really kind of surreal listening to the show while I was gone. And, like, listening to Bob and Hav and David pull down the fort. They talked about a lot of stuff. And I couldn't listen to it live. Because while I was in D.C., I didn't have any internet. And then when I was, like, when I came back that 1 week, I just was working all through Tuesday, so I did not, you know, I wasn't, or not.
We had a lot of fun while you were gone.
Yeah, you did. You, you bemoaned the fact that while I'm here, you don't get to have fun. And I decided that I was.
I don't think those are my exact words.
No, but... that was pretty much what you said. You were like, well, Lauren's here, we have to stay on topic and talk about Star Trek. And I was like, oh my goodness. What a fate.
Hey, so, you know, I like fun, you know, maybe you don't necessarily have fun all the time. All I'm saying is I go home with bruises all over my back.
Oh, dear. But you guys had some good episodes, although I have three quick points. First is that you were trying to talk about Star Trek economics with replicators. That's just a waste of time, okay? Replicators just make the whole thing fall apart and nothing works.
That's part of the show, Warren. We ask the tough questions.
There's no answer to that question, though, is what I'm saying, because the writers didn't understand what a replicator was when they invented it. And, like, it's just, okay, you just have to pretend the replicator isn't there, okay? You just have to ignore it, just look past it, okay? Just pretend pretend it's a transporter that some guy is putting food into on the other side, okay? If that helps, just pretend that's what it is.
Now I just have this image of a totally sealed off compartment of the ship that's the kitchen galley that one guy sleeps in all the time. He doesn't go anywhere else, and his only way out is the transporter now.
Yeah, there's no way for him to leave.
Excuse me.
Also, a couple of weeks ago, you guys were trying to figure out what form of government the Klingon Klingon government is, and if it's an oligarchy or not. It's totally an oligarchy. The dictionary definition of an oligarchy is a rule by the few, and that's what it is. It's ruled by this high council. They're not elected by anybody, and they don't really answer to anybody. Like, they are in charge. Now, it's got elements of other stuff in it. Clearly, if you are badass enough, you can become important. Like, Martok is the primo example of that. But lots of governments have elements of other things in them. Like, you know, our government is either a democracy with elements of plutocracy, which is ruled by the rich, or a plutocracy with elements of democracy, depending on what side of the scale you fall on. Because it's a lot of that's open to interpretations. So every government is going to have elements of other kinds in it, but primarily, it's clearly an oligarchy. Hav, I thought we were going to, if you're listening, I thought we were going to fight about the Millennium Falcon, and we haven't fought about it yet. So, you know, bring it.
You get to go next Tuesday onto Podcast UGC and have that fight if you want.
I'll see what I can do. All right, so... I think so. Today we have a couple of things planned.
Klingon Awareness Week. Yeah, actually, today is the last day of it. Actually, I think
I thought the last day was technically tomorrow. Or is it today?
No, it's today. Well, because it started on Sunday the 1st, so it goes till the 7th. The 1st through the 7th.
Oh, very good, very good.
One of the things that we got during Klingon Awareness Week was the Gates of Stovacor interview with Dan Stahl.
I haven't had a chance to listen to that. How was it?
It was a good interview. I definitely have a new appreciation for the Gates of Stovacor guys, you know, what they do, how they do it. Have you listened to them yet, Gates of Stovacor?
I haven't been able to know.
Oh my gosh, it's so good.
I'm probably going to start, though. I listen to a million podcasts at work, so I'll probably start listening.
I mean, David could definitely talk about it probably in more detail than I could, but it is like an audio drama where they're kind of portraying these Klingon characters. One of them, I think, is a Gorn as well, isn't he, David?
Yeah, well, the primary cast is four Klingons, and we exist within the Star Trek Online universe, so we play Klingon characters, but then there is like a ancillary cast or reoccurring cast, kind of like how we would have Barclay. You know, he's part of the cast, but he's not in every episode. But he would be mentioned and pop on from time to time. So yeah, we definitely bring in other people to do voices for us. You know, when there's extra characters that we need, and we did want to include more, especially because it is so focused on the. You know, it's based in Star Trek Online world. The Klingon faction includes more than just the Klingons, right? There's the Gorn, the Nausicaan, the Orion, and the Lethian. So we're gradually including more of those. And so far we've had a couple Gorn that have done really good Gorn examples. And it was before Star Trek Online included a Gorn character in their 2800 featured episode. So you could, you know, there's their take on what a Gorn would sound like. And I do like how they did it. But, you know, when we did our Gorn, it was before that. So it's just, you know, really good character voice people, you know, people from the community. One of our first Gorn, or like kind of set the bar for it, is Xander from Tribbles and Ecstasy, and he does a really good Gorn. But then we got people that are auditioning and, you know, throwing their hat in the ring for, you know, doing a Nausicaan. And, you know, the classic example that everybody would go by is play Dom Jot Human, you know, that awesome episode. So, yeah, it's definitely a different...
Just have a guy talk English all the time.
Yeah, and do a voice, because, you know, there's different... just like in the human race, you know, there's different voices will come out differently depending on the individual. And another thing that I think some people get hung up on, just a quick digression, it's like a soapbox moment or whatever, but for me in particular, anytime people think about doing a Klingon voice, it's, you know, always going to be like the deep, gravelly, raspy, you know, type of voice, and that's definitely a cool voice, and, you know, to some Klingons would definitely be like that, so I'm glad that there is that representation of a Klingon voice. But if you look at, you know, Michael Dorn, his voice was deep, but it wasn't like gravelly and raspy. But then you also look at, like, you know, Christopher Plummer as General Chang, you know, spouting Shakespeare, he didn't have a deep, gravelly, raspy voice. And then, you know, Christopher Lloyd. So there is, and then especially if you hear Mark Okrand, you know, talking, you know, speaking the actual Klingon language, there is a diversity of Klingon voices that could be out there. So, you know, it's nice to hear people do, you know, their take on a Gorn or a Nausicaan. And we need to go back and watch that Deep Space Nine episode with the Lethian to see what do the Lethian sound like, because we're going to be including, you know, one or two of those in the future episode. But just to kind of wrap it up on that, it is a different kind of podcast. We do try to address, you know, news of the game. If, like, a new ship comes out, or if there's new episodes or new developments in the game, we'll approach it and we'll, you know, discuss it. But we do it from in-universe, so it's different than, you know, the other podcasts that talk about the bugs in the mission, or, you know, the level design was so awesome, or, you know, whatever they talk about out, you know, from the gamer perspective. We're going to be doing it from in universe, so it's a different take. And, you know, we use sound effects and, you know, music and Foley type of thing, so we try to make it like a good audio, you know, experience.
Alright, well, I have three That's questions.
Very, very cool.
It is, but I actually have three questions about this podcast. Alright, so first question. Do you guys script it, or is it improv?
It's definitely scripted. I mean, each different person will come up with the core idea, and then we'll write out the script. And so, you know, I've been having a few ideas that I'm going to flesh out. So in that case, I would write the script, and so I would be writing the dialogue for the other cast members. And then before we do it, you know, I would give them the script and let them look it over and think, you know, do they like it? Do they want to say words differently? Or, you know, my character would never say that type of thing. So it's definitely scripted, and we all come up with different ideas. And a lot of the ideas are meant to reflect Klingon culture in general, but then a lot of it is based on the game. So one cool thing was there's the Klingons get a lot of good duty officer missions, you know, in the game. The proper, you know, missions or episode missions, you know, it's a big thing. Like, okay, Klingons are lacking on content in comparison to the Federation. But one thing we get that's really, really good is a lot of funny and interesting and good sounding duty officer missions. So sometimes we'll take that, and they're kind of like a cool title, and then you get like one paragraph describing what the mission would be. So we kind of use that as a springboard to say, oh, that sounds cool, so let's flesh it out into like a full... And another thing is that our episodes, generally, we'd shoot for around 15 minutes, you know, so it's a good enough length of time, but not too long. You know, some people, you know, don't want to listen to a whole hour or whatever of a, maybe some people do. I mean, I've thought, you know, maybe we'll do extra special episodes where it is longer, but for the most part, we'd shoot for around 15 minutes, so it's a good, you know, good download, good quick listen, and you could go to a couple episodes in a row, you know.
Okay.
It's so, really good stuff.
Yeah. All right. And I guess I'll just skip right to the last one. So if you get attacked by a Lethian and he uses his telepathic attack on you, and this is in PvP, does the person you use that attack on then have to go play a mini game where they are playing inside their coma-induced mind? Because yeah, that would be so cool.
And I'm sure Albert Pirate, if he listens to this show right now, wants your head on a spike.
Oh, that's hardly new. All right, so I think
what? It's hardly new.
I'm just saying I'm not the most cryptic friendly podcaster in the universe.
Well, you don't even play Star Trek Online.
Exactly.
Okay.
All right.
But what I wanted to mention about the Gates of Stovacor interview specifically with Dan Stahl is one, there's a huge thread that's in relation to it on the forums where Roach made mention that he thought that this was going to lead to Gates of Stovacor not getting any more like dev contact. It was one of the things he brought up. Now, I want to say this right at the Gates of Stovacor, guys. I hope that is not true at all, because none of that that's on the forums is your fault, like at all. None of it. That is the forum community being the forum community. Now, that being said, when I first listened to the interview, I have to admit I was a little bit nervous when I was first listening to it, because a lot of it sounded like Dan Stahl, once again, kind of putting out, you know, a lot of words on how the game's going to be awesome. And whatnot. And I kind of went away with it feeling, you know, this kind of sounds like a lot of the same lip service we got before when we had this big gap where not a whole lot of stuff was being released. But when I went back and I thought about it a little more, I listened to the interview again, and then I kind of mashed it up with what has come out in a slow trickle ever since Dan's come back, I'm not really as worried about it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
My concern is still there, that's for sure, as I'm sure any Stove player who's been playing the game for however long, the past year or 2 years, since, you know, closed beta or open beta, we all have those concerns, but I do genuinely think now at this point that things are going to get better. And if you listen to the way Dan talks, there are a number of questions that the Gates of Stovacor guys ask that Dan says, you know what, I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about the entirety of Star Trek Online and the KDF in its entirety, and what we're going to be doing about that. And he's volunteering a lot of information that wasn't really even some of the questions the Gates of Stovacor guys had. So I implore everybody listening now, if you haven't listened to the Gates of Stovacor interview, please go listen to it. Is the Gates of Stovacor website up again as of yet?
The last I checked, it's still down. But we are aware of what's the issue, and it should have already been back up. So we're just, you know, any day now. And there is a backup site. So that in the thread that you mentioned, it does give a link to the backup. But the other thing is, when the site does come back up, is we did submit, you know, questions beforehand, and he emailed us back, you know, good answers to those questions, and it's like, okay, this is what we're going to talk about. And then once we get into the interview, we're following, you know, basically that script or that line of questioning. And at a certain point, he's like, you know what, let's just talk. You know, it kind of goes off the script of or off the, right, the prepared questions. And so that was kind of a surprise to us, but it was a pleasant surprise. We were happy, like, okay, let's just, you know, banter. Let's just discuss the situation. And there was a lot of good, you know, information out there. And I know, you know, I've been a Klingon player all throughout Star Trek Online. I've actually started in the community before launch. I was like, you know, on the forums and talking about, oh, I can't wait to play Klingon and all that. And then I was actually part of the Friends and Family beta before closed beta. So I've been on Star Trek Online, like, from the beginning. I mean, I actually started following development back when it was on Perpetual. But, you know, in terms of what we have today with Cryptic and Star Trek Online. So obviously all throughout that time, it's like, you know, the way the Klingon faction started, people were like, either, oh, they don't care about the Klingons, or it's just monster play and this and that. And, you know, and at times I would share into that feeling and voice those, you know, complaints. But then over time, you know, I started looking at it from a bigger picture and looking into what, well, why is things up the way they are? And so, and I knew that it was going to spark a lot of discussion, a lot of debate, and, you know, the forums being the forums, I figured it was going to get, you know, positive responses and a lot of negative. But, you know, it's just kind of was ironic to me that, like, you know, being a Klingon player in the past, where I'd be like, I was right along, you know, almost getting the torches and the pitchforks out to join the mob of they hate Klingons or whatever. But then as time went on, I've, you know, lightened up and taken the more of an understanding approach. And especially with this interview, it's like, I know that Pathfinder on the forums, who's Hauk on the show, him and, you know, Roach and all, basically all of us in Gates came out with a better feeling after that. And it's like, you know, we got some answers of why things went the way they did in the past, but also where we're at and where we're going. So I was kind of like, okay, you know, we could kind of breathe a sigh of relief. We know, obviously, it's still not where we want it to be, and it may not happen overnight, but we had a good feeling about it. But then to go to the forums and there's all this, you know, flame wars and ranting and the negativity, and it's like, oh, great. And so that's why I kind of wondered the same thing about what Roach said of like, well, is this going to be a reflection on us? Or are they going to be like, okay, not like, okay, we're not blaming the Gates of Stovelcore guys, but it's like, well, we're not doing that again. You know, I've kind of wondered that. So hopefully, you know, it'll continue, and we'd love to have Dan back and even other, you know, developers, because I know I'd like to address questions and just comments to Kestrel, who's like writing a lot of the story for Star Trek Online, so I'd like to see that happen at some point. But yeah, hopefully we'll be able to get Dan back on in the future, and it hasn't, you know, I wouldn't want, and not even just us, you know, but in terms of Dan or the devs going to other podcasts, you know, even All Things Trek, because I think it's good for them to have an open communication with the player base, and, you know, keep the dialogue going. And, you know, we don't want promises of things way down the future, because things may change. But, you know, if they're going to be able to be candid and open and tell us what they can tell us, you know, that's always going to be helpful.
What would a Klingon pitchfork even look like? I imagine it would probably have lots of extra prongs and speed holes.
Well, they have pain sticks. Yeah. They're set.
Okay. You can't really pitch hay with those, though.
What? Klingons don't pitch hay?
Well, they gotta have... That's another thing I want to talk about a little later. Someone has to do the not-fighting jobs.
So, yeah, I really felt, and, you know, we have this, you know, sort of soapbox, All Things Trek podcast that we have available here. I wanted to get on the box and pretty much just give a shout-out to Gates of Silvercore for, one, doing the interview, and two, don't be disheartened by what's going on in the forums, like, at all. Don't worry about that, you know. And I wish upon you guys, you know, much more success and, you know, more interviews, which I think you'll get. I think you'll get more interviews.
Forums are strange and dangerous places.
They are.
Where people say things they often don't mean.
Yeah.
This is a thing that happens.
Not a lot of people won't let go of the past in there anyway.
Yeah, that's true. All right. So before we get fully into this Klingon mode, I wanted to talk a little bit about The Needs of the Many, because I read that while I was in D.C.
Yes.
Oh, nice.
Well, because it was a funny story. So The Needs of the Many, like, fell on my leg, and my leg was stuck because The Needs of the Many is so heavy. And so, like, I could either keep my leg off, or I could read the Needs of the Many and flip the pages to get its weight off my foot so I could escape. No, I'm just kidding. Bob lent it to me.
Actually, you finally read it, because I lent that to you, like, months ago.
Right, and then all of
this... And I saw it every time I come over to your place. It's sitting on the shelf, untouched. I'm like, hey, Oren, when are you going to read this book that has to do with the gap between Nemesis and Star Trek Online?
Well, all it took was a week of no internet, no work, and the only other thing to do being lose it to my brother at chess. And I read it. And I read it pretty quick, actually. It's a good read. That's... Like, it is a, before I say anything else, it is a very well-written book, and I do have to compliment Michael A. Martin, whoever this Jake Sisko fellow is. yeah. I'm not sure who that guy is. I never heard of him.
Jake Sisko?
Sisko? Jake Sisko?
I think it's Sisko.
Sisko? I don't know. But Michael A. Martin did a really good job. Also, his initials spell MAM, which I think is funny.
Is it really?
Yeah, M-A-M. MAM.
MAM. Okay.
Anyway, it's a really well-written book, and for anyone who's not familiar with it, the basic thing is that Star Trek Online story starts off in 2409, and the last...
The game does.
Yeah, Star Trek Online, yeah, the game. Starts off in 2409, but the end of Nemesis was 2379, so there's obviously, that's a 30-year time jump.
Yep.
And it makes sense why they wanted to do that time jump, because they were like, they didn't want to be completely enslaved to what had just been happening on the screen. They wanted to be able to do their own thing, so they have this time jump, and that all makes sense. But then they decided they needed something to kind of bridge the gap for people who were interested in what happened.
Right.
And so that was Mr. Martin's job. He did as well a job as he could have, honestly, I mean, looking at it. And I really liked the conceit of it, because the book is told through a series of interviews that Jake Sisko is doing. And Jake Sisko, I guess, in his 50s by that point?
He's 40s. 12 at the beginning of DS9, 7 years later, so he's 19 in 2374.
Yeah.
So, in his 2380, 40s. So he's a 25 in 2380, which then we're jumping, yeah, so about mid-50s.
Yeah, so he's doing all these, so he's done all these interviews, and, like, that's the premise of the book. And that's,
that would be, just as a quick reference, I'm trying to picture him like that. If you remember, Jake Sisko was seen as an older man in the Deep Space Nine episode, The Visitor, and he's like older than 50, or, you know, he definitely looks like he's, you know, up there. And so now it's played by Tony Todd, who also is Kern, Worf's brother. But I do want to just, before you continue, I just wanted to chime in a little bit. I do appreciate the book, and it was well written. I have it. I've read it. But I do want to give a quick shout-out to Kestrel, the writer for Star Trek Online. It was basically Kestrel's job to fill in the gaps of what happened between Nemesis and Star Trek Online, and that originally was given out in the form of the path to 2409 on the Star Trek Online website, and they would do it in incremental updates, and then they took that and then used that as the basis for the book.
Huh. All right. All right. Well, this suddenly got a lot more awkward. Okay, because, I mean, I'm sorry.
We'll just carry on with your review.
All right. Well, because...
Just keeping that in mind.
The reason this is awkward is that I really like the book, and I really like the way it's written, but I really don't like the story, and I think the story doesn't make any sense. And it was easier to say that back when it was just some nameless writer who maybe didn't work at the company anymore, but I know everyone really loves Kestrel, and she sounds really cool, and it sounds like she's a pretty good writer. I don't want to, like, be insulting anybody.
I believe in Kestrel's ability to write good fiction, and I believe that she's, you know, a good fiction writer and that she's a Star Trek fan. However, I think that perhaps the fact that she was curbed into having to write a lot of story that had to be consistent with what the gameplay of Star Trek Online had to be kind of compromised some of that fiction.
Well,
I feel. That's just my opinion.
That's probably what it is. It's mainly this whole war with the Undyne, or the species.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is that book, it kind of takes, it kind of sets apart a lot of what was written, because she had to write, and the thing about the path to 2409, and you could actually go read it on a Memory Beta, you know, obviously Memory Alpha is the website, you know, the encyclopedia wiki type for Star Trek canon, but Memory Beta is for, you know, soft canon, and you could go look up the path to 2409 on there. But everything is written in, like, you know, overview or quick synopsis summary type of thing. So a lot of times it was just get to, like, you know, the main events and what led to the events and not really fleshing it out. So that's a difficult thing for a writer. But then she covers a lot of ground on that path to 2409, and that book kind of takes a chunk of it and really focuses on that, you know, and it is a lot about the Undyne. So they touch upon, you know, the Borg a little bit. It'll touch on the Romulans, but it's really focused on the Undyne. Whereas the path to 2409, it's a lot of it's like the whole universe. And I just also, she's a voracious reader. She basically, you could almost, you know, mention any book and she'll be able to tell you what happened in it and name characters. She's like an avid reader. So I would have to give total props and respect to Kestrel. But she does have a tough job at times, you know, and then there's also CBS would have to approve things, you know. She can't just make things up randomly. It's like there is, you know, a world. She has some freedom, I mean, a lot of freedoms, the way I interpret it. But then obviously Cryptic and CBS have parameters that she can't really go beyond, where it's like all of a sudden the Klingons are all just happy, peaceful hippies or something, you know. There's a framework that she would have to stick within, and it is just a tough job to fill in so many gaps, but have to do it in condensed form, you know, whereas the book was able to really focus on certain things, like almost with a microscope, which the path to 2409 didn't get to do. So I was always hoping or wondering if they're ever going to do another book. Like, okay, that one was good. Now let's have a book about the Romulan aspect of that time period, or the Borg, or this or that, you know?
A Romulan book would be really cool, I think.
Well, I love Romulans.
That would definitely, I think, give a lot more insight into what happened, one, right at the Shinzon incident, and then two, the Hobus incident.
Maybe they could explain why the Romulan military felt it was necessary to install Shinzon as Praetor. Because, like, that's actually a big part of the plot of Nemesis that a lot of people miss, I've discovered, is that, like, Shinzon didn't just, like, grab power on his own. He was supported by the Romulan military, and it was never really explained why the Romulan military picked Shinzon to be their, you know, a guy who, A, isn't Romulan, B, is, like, allied with Remans, who they apparently all hate and think are lame. And it's like that part was never explained. That could have been interesting.
I thought it was explained the first scene in the movie.
No, it wasn't. It was explained that they did it, and it was explained that they made this deal that once they put him in power...
Two military guys are in the Senate, and they say, you know, if we ally our forces with Shinzon, not even the Federation can stop us. Right?
What forces? Shinzon has a ship. Like, what forces?
The Riemans. The Riemans.
The Riemans are some dudes on a planet with mining shovels.
Right, but they're subservient right now to the Romulans.
The Riemans are already allied with the Romulans by force. If the Romulan military is concerned about the Riemans, they should kill Shinzon because he's their biggest threat to them losing the Riemans. This whole story makes no sense, and they never really explained it. It was just sort of like assumed that because I guess military coups are evil, they will also ally with the other evil person in the room, because that's how evil works, right?
Evil.
But anyway, to say just a couple more things I really liked about the book, I liked the mix of interviews with canon characters and new characters, like ones that we recognize from the show, and then new guys. I liked the ending with Picard's son on the champagne vineyard. I thought that was cool. I liked the interview with Maddox to show that he was no longer douchebag number one, Starfleet.
Yeah.
I really liked the interview what's his name? The guy, the genetically engineered guy who can do back
Jack.
Jack. That was really cool.
Yes, and you picked up that it was him as you were reading it, right?
Yeah. And like the two guys from Temporal Investigations, I liked all those, and I really liked how none of the interviews were with the super big shots like Riker or Picard or Sisko. They were from some of them were made.
Sisko would have been a little hard to do.
They would have found a way if they wanted to.
Well, there's a really good interview in there with Annika Hansen, aka 7 of 9, about briefly touching on the Borg.
That one is that's what I like to call the 7 of 9 denial interview, where Sisko where Jake is like, this was probably all Janeway's fault, and then 7 of 9 like, nuh-uh. And Jake was like, well, look at all these reasons that it was Janeway's fault. 7 of 9 was like, nuh-uh. And he's like, you know, putting her hand over her ears.
La-la-la-la-la-la.
Which is probably my favorite thing about the book, is that everything is Janeway's fault. but, like...
Do you feel vindicated a little bit now with all our Janeway hate?
A little bit. But see, that's actually the thing about this, the book, that the story that I was just, like, reading it, this whole thing is like, this doesn't make sense. Like, Species 8472 ships can blow up planets. They can destroy Borg cubes in like one shot. They should have wiped the Federation right out of space in the opening wave. Like, the idea that the Federation could possibly fight a war against this species is absurd. And, like, no amount of technobabble is going to fix that. And so it's just...
Well, I think the book, and also if you follow some of the storylines of the game, just on a quick little side note, I read the book before, as soon as it came out, you know, so I need to reread it because it's been, about 2 years or however long when it came out. But it really focuses on the Undyne War, and then you play the game, and, you know, the Undyne from the Federation standpoint, the Undyne are a big thing at the beginning, and then after a certain, you know, levels or a certain rank that you achieve, you basically don't really hear from the Undyne anymore, and it becomes about the Borg threat or the True Way, and it's like, it kind of just felt odd that the book sets up such a big thing about the Undyne War, and then the game kind of uses that, but then moves on. But the thing about what you were just saying about the planet killing and all that, the book sets it up and talks about it, but then also the missions in the game. The Undyne weren't really trying to just come at it full force, you know, like a frontal assault type of thing. They're trying to be more infiltrating or, you know, subversive, where they want to replace people, you know, like supplant and, you know, replicate, and they send in a clone or the imposter and kind of defeat people from within by changing the course of action or the course of history, or, you know, install people in a big place of power, and then, you know, make it'd be like, you know, taking our president away and putting an imposter in the place of the president, and then
the Manchurian candidate.
Okay. All right, right. Well, yeah. I understand that that's the premise. But like, we've seen how Species 8472 deals with threats to their existence. They do not do things in half measures, okay? They, you know...
Great men are not peacemakers. They are conquerors.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to make that argument, but we saw how they dealt with the Borg, all right? They did not... They were not going to go mamby-pamby on this. This was all or nothing. And obviously, maybe they could decide that a different course of action was called for in this situation, but there are a number of instances where it talks about Starfleet ships fighting 8472 ships. That should not be able to happen. Like, a Species 8472 ship, like... If this was actually a situation where Species 8472 doesn't just wipe out the Federation, it should be really obvious that they could, but have chosen not to for some reason. And everyone should be asking the question, why haven't they wiped us out? In much the same way, this was one of my biggest problems with Battlestar Galactica, was that it was increasingly obvious as the show went on that the Cylons could have wiped out Galactica, but had chosen not to. And no one was asking why. Like, no one seemed concerned as to why this was the case. That's a big part of my problem with this conflict. And then the other issue that I have with it is that they keep, like, talking about this Undyne infiltration like it's the scariest thing since sliced bread. And I only say that because I find sliced bread to be terrifying. I mean, it's sliced. You don't know what it's going to do. It's already been cut. It's vicious.
Sometimes I think words just come out of your mouth and you have no idea what you're saying.
I've not figured that out yet.
I guess 41 episodes in, I haven't until just now.
Well, 40, maybe 42 will be your lucky number, Bob.
is the answer to the universe, isn't it?
But, like, they keep talking about these Species 8472 infiltrations, right? And how they're super scary and how they're super effective, but they don't really seem to be. Like, apparently they just will sometimes just reveal themselves just by accident. And, like, they keep mentioning how these are way scarier than the Founders. And, like, first of all, I'm just kind of... I'm inherently distrustful, and I have a knee-jerk reaction against anything that comes into a franchise and is like, hey, this thing that the franchise did before, we're doing it, but our version is way cooler. And they keep telling you about how much cooler their version of it is. I mean, you know, to use a different example, it would be like if they made another show about a ship being lost in a different part of the galaxy, and they kept referencing Voyager and how much worse they have it than Voyager. Like, you know, that would be in kind of poor taste.
This time we're lost in the Gamma Quadrant.
You know, that would be in kind of poor tastes, right?
Uh-huh.
I feel like that's kind of the same way with this book, is that they keep bringing up how this is worse than the Founders, when in fact the Founders seemed way more effective. Because, like, you know, like the Founders could, you know, obviously, like, I guess the Species 8472 are supposed to become perfect genetic duplicates of us. I'm a little unclear how that's different from the Founders. I guess they get our memories, too. Which, according to some sources in this book, is actually a hindrance. But like,
because Worf was attacked by Species 8472.
Yeah,
and he's not sure if he's actually an infiltrator or not.
Right, and so that, like, that one part was really cool. I really liked that part. But as far as actual effective infiltrations go, they don't seem very effective because they just will sometimes just randomly pop out because of reasons. Whereas that never happened with the Founders. Also, they mentioned blood tests and how you could find the Founder with blood tests. No one ever found a Founder with a blood test. Like, ever. Every Founder in the universe knew how to fool blood tests, apparently. So, blood tests are right out the window. Also the Founders, I don't know, the Founders just did it first, I guess, and it seems like they realized that they came up with the storyline, and then they were like, the Founders already did this. We have to be cooler than the Founders.
We have
otherwise,
to be cooler than the Founders.
Otherwise, we will seem less cool by comparison.
Maybe it's all, you know, and I'm just pitching this out there. Maybe it's just to see if the Alpha Quadrant and Beta Quadrant powers are actually worth fighting. If they're actually going to be a problem for Species 8472. Because that's something that's brought up in Voyager, right? When they come across, it's In the Flesh, I think, is the episode, is that right?
The one where they make the truce with what turns out to be a small faction of 8472, which you figure they would have mentioned at the time, but I guess not. I guess they were selfish.
Because Species 8472 isn't really quite clear if, you know, humanity, quote-unquote humanity, is going to be a, you know, an actual threat to Species 8472. I mean, especially if we're coming from it with the standpoint of they can just sweep the floor with the Borg, right? They can totally just, like, clear the Borg out,
until Janeway came along. Until Janeway came along and gave the Borg super weapons. Come on, Janeway.
Didn't think that through, did you?
Which makes it, you know, the whole thing about that one group that she made a truce with only being a small fraction of Species 8472, that makes her decision seem even sillier. It's like, well, because it's like, Voyager, like, she makes this decision. She's going to give the Borg these weapons to fight Species 8472 because Species 8... And, like, part of her motivation is that she's decided that Species 8472 is evil. But, like, then we find out there are actually multiple groups of them, just like there are any species. And it's just like, well, maybe you should have thought of that, Captain, before you made this decision. Just a little bit.
Well, that was, I think, just focusing on her specific problem at the time.
Yeah, well, that's part of my problem.
But getting back to Star Trek Online, in this, the context of Species 8472, maybe they're just feeling things out to see if it's worthwhile to wage war on these species, right? They've put the Klingon Empire and the Federation against each other, which is, you know, fairly obvious as you look further and further into it. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, maybe, but, like, that's... Sorry, go ahead.
I still think that Chancellor Jempok might be an Undyne. That's a popular conspiracy theory. But at the same time, you're comparing him to the Founders.
I think it's Quinn.
It could be both of them. They're both, you know, but, you know, the whole backstory, like, if you read The Path to 2409, the way that Jempok came to power and, you know, some of the directions he's taking things, it kind of seems like, well, that might... Either they're just it could just be a Duras, you know, a crazy Klingon bent on, you know, their own agenda. But, you know, other people have said, well, what about it if it's a changeling from the Dominion? But I kind of think it might be an Undyne. But if you look at the Founders, they were bent on, like, domination and control. Like, they wanted to be, like, in power, right? So that's why they wanted to, you know, invade and take over. And if you're not going to be with us, then we have to kill you. Whereas maybe with the Undyne, they kind of are just wanting to, you know, have more control over the quadrant without being like, you know, like a military conquest type of thing. If we need to be like the dominant power, maybe they're trying to. That's why they would infiltrate to, like, you know, be able to steer the different powers in a direction that is, like, least threatening to them, to themselves, and so kind of, like, you know, influence it from within, but without saying, we're just going to kill you and take your planet and conquer you, and, you know, the same way that the Founders would. And, you know, and at the same time, maybe they just want to have, you know, understanding on one level and then be able to control it at the same time, because, you know, when they would, even in the book, but in some of the missions and just the vibe that I get, is that on some levels there is the open hostility, but then on other times, you know, they put an Undyne into place and they kind of just are like a sleeper agent, or like they just sit there, you know, like, so it's like, well, what are they doing for all that time? They're not, you know, doing terrorist activities or whatever. So it's kind of like information gathering or intelligence and, you know, that type of thing. So surveillance, maybe, I don't know. It's really, it does need to be fleshed out more. You know, there's a lot there, but then there's still a lot of unanswered questions. So I think, it would be, you know, and in Star Trek Online, they're talking about they need more in-game content, and they're going to be doing more featured episodes. I think it is, you know, there's still enough fertile ground there that they could bring back the Undyne and, you know, and do more with it instead of just saying, oh, well, we've done that, now we need to come up with something completely brand new. It's like, well, there's still a lot of unanswered questions with that that could be addressed.
Well, see, that's part of my point, is that Species 8472 in this conflict doesn't seem to be going for any definite objective. Like, it's because they're going...
They're,
like,
just doing stuff.
They're just doing stuff. And no one seems terribly confused by that. Everyone's, like, afraid, but I don't remember ever reading a point in this book where anyone sat down and was like, all right, what exactly is Species 8472 trying to accomplish? And what that tells me is that that's not actually part of the story. That's just because the writers don't know what Species 8472 is trying to accomplish, so they're just trying to make it seem vague and scary because they haven't plotted that part out yet.
Uh-huh.
And so, like,
it does make it more creepy, you know, like the unknown. You know they're coming after you, but you don't really know why, you know. Whereas with the Borg, you know what their objective is. With the Dominion, you know what they're after. But when, you know, with the Undyne, they're, you know, it's not known all the time.
Hold on, we know why. We know the why is because we gave the Borg weapons to kill them. That's why. We don't know how yet. So it's and the other thing about it that's kind of weird is that sometimes Undyne infiltrators will forget that they're Undyne and just be human or whatever species they're pretending to be. But then sometimes they get drunk and lose control and turn into Undyne, which implies that like, it's a controlled thing that they have to constantly work to maintain, but at the same time implies that it's just a passive thing that they become more and more as they, you know, as they, like, as they last longer in it. And so that part was confusing. And again, no one brings up this weird contradiction that is clearly
It was established in Voyager, right? And I think continued on, maybe fleshed out further in the book. But basically, the difference between what the Undyne do and the founders of the Dominion, right, the Changelings basically are like that gelatinous ooze stuff, and they take the shape of a thing, and then, you know, they look like it. And on some kind of level, you know, they rearrange their molecules or whatever, kind of like it reminded me of like the T-1000 or whatever. But in terms of the Undyne, they actually rewrite their DNA code. So it's like, it's a different process of what, like, if you're going to say, Orin is a change, became a changeling, or, you know, a changeling is becoming Orin. Basically, they're just changing their outer, you know, geometry and the color, you know, of their surface or whatever to look like Orin. Cause that's where there's that classic scene where in DS9 where the alien guy is spinning a mace on a, you know, a morning star type of mace thing, and he throws it at Odo's head, and it just passes through him because it's not
his skull. The look on that guy's face is priceless.
That's awesome. And he makes a noise. What? Like what? But that just shows you a changeling might look humanoid, but there really is no skull, you know, that type of thing. Whereas with the Undyne. Or I guess it's I'm being told it's not Undyne, it's Undyne. It's a Greek word. I've heard it said Undyne. I've heard Undine. Different video games have used it.
They picked a name.
There you go. 8472. But they actually rewrite their DNA code, so you know that's where they kind of become the person in terms of, you know, they're becoming more humanoid. You know, they would have actual veins that have blood in it. In terms of, you know, a changeling would have to conceal a little vial of blood and, you know, act like they're spilling it out of a hole that they create or whatever. Whereas it did seem odd that, like, you know, sometimes it doesn't work out right. You know, if they try to get to somebody's DNA, you know, maybe that person has a, you know, genetic defects, or they have a particular genetic disease or something where, you know, it creates a problem for them to recreate or to maintain that DNA. But it was kind of creepy, you know, kind of like Body Snatchers or some kind of thing. Like, you don't know if it's one thing to say, okay, you could look at a family member or the president or somebody and think, are they real or are they, you know, a clone or a changeling or 8472? But it was really creepy when they got to the point of, like, the person thinking, am I one of those? Like, you know, not being sure about themselves. That was kind of a creepy approach to it.
All right, but hold on, because I'm not entirely done with this point. Because, you know, well, what, am I ever done with a point? Okay, so the thing about this is that the changelings, like, they don't just look like a thing. They are the thing. They made it pretty clear that if you, like, you know, you scan a changeling, you will scan whatever it is they are, because that's what they are. They aren't just, like, a sack of goo inside a rock shape.
That's why they had to do, like, phaser squeeze and blood tests.
Right. Now, the reason why they turn back into goo if you do a blood test, supposedly, is that
because they separate.
Yeah, the part that you take away from them doesn't have enough consciousness to maintain its form. So that's the changelings become the thing. Now, assumedly, changelings are not detailed enough to replicate memories. I think we can be fairly certain that changelings can't do that. Apparently, the Undyne can, and that's cool. Don't get me wrong. That's an interesting new take, that the Undyne can replicate memories. The DNA thing, that bothers me, because changing DNA doesn't change what you look like. If you change all your DNA into pig DNA, you will die, but you will not change into a pig.
it's biological technobabble.
Like, I don't know. I would have preferred it if they had just said it's a weird, mysterious process we don't entirely understand yet. But they keep saying DNA. And,
like, right, that's the best understanding we have of it, is that they rewrite their DNA.
But rewriting your DNA doesn't change what you look like. Because your DNA is what your body uses as a blueprint to build you in the first place. It doesn't use it to. It doesn't constantly check. That's like saying if you snuck into a basement and changed the building's blueprints, the building would change.
Walking stem cell.
Maybe, I don't know.
Maybe that's what species 8472 is.
I mean, haven't we captured some corpses? Couldn't we figure that shit out? Pardon me.
Maybe. You know, I'm sure there are some dead undead. I've certainly killed a fair share of a species 8472 myself.
I also think
just being a Star Trek Online.
I also think it's really funny that they are that you kill them, like you fight them at the low levels. Is that the undead are low levels?
Well, you used to. They kind of changed that a little bit to where you're either with a fleet of other ships, either Federation or Klingon, then you're fighting like a dreadnought, or you're chasing down this species 8472 imposter. In one mission called Diplomatic Orders, where you're supposed to take this Vulcan ambassador from Vulcan to Pajem, and he turns out to be an infiltrator. And he very much knows he is, by the way, too, that he's this infiltrator. But most of the time, you shoot him for a little while, but then he runs away.
Mm-hmm.
So the low levels, you're not really fighting species 8472 so much.
Okay.
Now, when you get to something like Terra Dome, oh man, that's like a dungeon crawl, all of species 8472.
Terra Dome, huh? Two yes. Starfleet officers enter, one leaves, and is also an undyne.
Yes, that's right. That's
oh, exactly. And the big one is the big boss is Master Blaster.
He's just,
well, his name is Terra Dome Commander.
No, it's a small undyne on top of a larger undyne. Sorry, Bob. It's my fault. I'm trying to kill Bob as he's drinking some soda.
Uh-oh.
Oh, but the other thing about so, also there was the baseball game, right? And the baseball game I thought was kind of funny.
Oh, yeah, with the Gorn pitcher or whatever.
But I thought it was weird that it was, like, humans fighting Gorn in a baseball game over a Gorn-Klingon dispute. Wouldn't it have made more sense for the Klingons to send a baseball team? I figure the Klingons would have been all like, no one will fight our battles for us. We will learn this baseball game, and we will play it with honor. You know, to do my worst Klingon impression ever.
It's cool, you were shouting.
Yeah, but like, it just, I don't know, I would have liked it more if there had been a Klingon baseball team. I think that would have been fun. Because also, yeah. Then we could have had a more even game instead of having the humans just get wiped all over the floor.
Yeah.
I also thought it was funny that the humans just sort of assumed that the Gorn would accept a challenge on a game they couldn't play. It's like, like they intentionally stacked this game in their favor and then were really surprised when the Gorn showed up and actually knew what they were doing. I guess I don't know. That struck me as a little weird.
Yeah, like, watch out for those shifty Gorn.
Maybe is baseball like top secret information in the Federation? Did they not think the Gorn knew could find out what baseball was?
Well, to be fair, if I was plotting, you know, if I was an empire who maybe had military designs on another empire, for
an instance, empire or an ump?
I want to punch you so hard. Just right square in the face. Right.
There you go. They could have used the Klingon umpire.
I think that would have been a little unfair.
David, don't you help him out. don't be helping him. Warren doesn't need it. We're coming close to the top of the hour. I think we're going to go to a quick music break is what we're going to do here. Give us all a chance to freshen up a little bit after our hour-long discussion about a lot of little different things. David, what's in store for us?
I think we're going to go to some dark materia in support of Klingon Awareness Week.
Kapla!
Right, we have to talk
Kapla.
About that.
Kapla.
You're listening to the All Things Trek podcast. Music breaks have been cut out for copyright reasons. If you'd like to hear the music, please tune in live at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, Saturdays.
And we're back. This is All Things Trek with Bob and who? Who again? What?
Some guy. Who are you
Oren, I think.
Oren Ishii? I don't know. Just some guy wandered into the studio.
That's right. Welcome back to All Things Trek, folks. Oh, well, my God. Let's try that again. Welcome back to All Things Trek. I'm trying to get used to my transformation with the DNA and whatnot there.
Yep.
Being infiltrated at all. If you, too, would like to interact with the show, you can go to the community tab and go to IRC chat room, enter in a name, and you, too, can yell at us about how we trash Voyager. You can also email us, allthingstrek@hotmail.com. We also have a Twitter you can follow, which is @allthingstrek.
Oh, man, please send us some hate mail. We haven't got any hate mail. I'm so excited for our first hate mail. Totally reading
sure
it.
Sure, we'll get it. So there's this thing called Klingon Awareness Week happening, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about that. Because this is not the needs of the many. This is not Needs of the Many Awareness Week.
It is not Needs of the Many Awareness Week.
Although it could be.
It could be. Anyway, so.
All right.
Well, so. we aren't primarily a Star Trek Online podcast.
No, we are not.
So, but I do want to mention that at the end of the show, which for us is 3 p.m. Pacific, which is 6 p.m. Eastern. There's going to be a Bat'leth tournament. David, you got all sorts of juicy details on that, don't you?
Yep, definitely. It's you definitely want to be a part of it. It's going to be a good, fun event. It's sponsored by Gates of Stovelcore and Tribbles, or I should say Targs in Ecstasy. And it's going to be happening, like you said, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. You're going to want to go over to the first city on Kronos and meet up at the Bat'leth tournament arena map, which is, you know, you got to go into the barracks, you got to go down the ramp, you know, down the hall, take a right, you know, go towards the door, and it's basically where you start off as a Klingon character. So, but, you know, so we're going to all meet up there, then we're going to start the tournament, which is going to be loading up a one-on-one PvP map, and there's going to be referees to keep it, you know, keep it in check, because the rules for the event, it's melee weapons only, and it's only for Klingon characters. It is Klingon Awareness Week, so grab your Klingon character, you know, that you've been either working on, you know, your brand new character, or your the one that you've dusted off that you haven't played for a long time, but bring your Klingon character, and it's melee weapons only, but, you know, it's a Bat'leth tournament, you know, in name, but if you want, you could bring a Lerpa, you know, you could bring the Falchion or Falchion sword or whatever, but it's only melee weapons, no powers, no kits, no armor, no heals, and no respawns. Once you're down, you're down. You know, so fight, give it all you can, but once you're down, that's it, it's over. And what we mean by...
Or is it like a big battle royale?
It's one-on-one, and the winner of that match will advance, and so it's like a, you know, a bracketed tournament type of thing, and there's going to be awards for first, second, and third place. But what we mean by, you know, some of that was self-explanatory. You know, no kits, no armor, and no heals. But what we mean by no powers is that, you know, some races get racial inherent abilities, and then some classes get a class inherent ability. So, like, one example of a class inherent ability is if you're a tactical character, at one point during your leveling up process, you get an ability called Security Team, and you hit that, and two security officers beam down and will fight, you know, shoot at your target. And that's not based on a kit, you know, it's just a class trait or a class ability. So no class-related powers. But then also some of the races have racial skills, like a, you know, a Reeman or, well, that's not a playable race, but, you know, a Lethian would have a psychic attack. Or if you're a liberated Borg...
Right, the mental minigame.
Right. Right, where you have to slide the tiles around to create the puzzle image or whatever. But a liberated Borg has the ability to infect people with nanites, and that kind of, like, you know, puts them into a weakened state or whatever. Yeah, it's really cool, too. There's a big green blob that shoots out, and, you know, they get all... They get stunned, or they start getting really slow and, you know, lumber around because they got all kinds of nanites in them. But so yeah, so no powers from your race or for your class, or no kits and no armor, no heals. Like heals would be, you know, a science ability, but on another level would be like hypo sprays, you know, or like the items that give you a heal. So it's just melee only. Just, you know, fight it out with your weapon of choice. And like we said, once you're down, you're down. The winner moves on, and we'll keep going until there's a winner. And the first place is going to get a duty officer pack, a special rare console, which I'll talk about in a minute. This says on the forum thread 500 cryptic points, but I think Xander said that it's 1,000. So we'll you know, check in on that. At very least, you'll get a 500 I was about to say Vice Admiral, but it's a Lieutenant General level Bat'leth. So yeah, you could actually win a high level, you know, Bat'leth from the Bat'leth tournament. Second place will get a Duty Officer pack and a Pet pack, which will, you know, give you the Sealot Cub. Third place gets...
It's adorable.
Third place gets a Duty Officer pack. Yep, it's a Vulcan animal, right? Is that right? And so... third place gets a duty officer pack and 1,000 skill point bonus pool. And that's the item that you activate it, and it gives you a skill bonus, basically like a double XP or, you know, XP bonus that lasts for 1,000 points. Because there is different items where you just get a skill point bonus for an hour, and I think that's like 20% more. It's skill points, but basically to other MMO players, skill points represents your XP, you know, to level up. So there is one item that just gives you a bonus to your XP or your skill points for an hour. There's another one that's 8 hours. This one is a pool because it's no time limit on it. You just, you know, activate it, and it's going to be on that character for as long as it takes to achieve that 1,000 skill points. So that's just, you know, a good way to level up because, you know, it's Klingon Awareness Week. Some people are playing a Klingon for the first time. Other people are playing an alt that they haven't played for a long time, and they might need to level it up. But for the first place prize, that rare special console pack, that came from the Cardassian lockbox items, and it's a console that would only be available to the other faction. So
you're talking about Super Impulse console,
yeah,
right?
exactly. And normally that's only available to the Federation characters, and you have to buy that Gladius from the Sea Store to get that console. Console pack, if you're a Klingon character and you open that console pack, you'll get that Gladius's console. So that's the only way to get it on the Klingon side, because normally it's only available to the Federation characters. So that's a good, you know, rare bonus to win the battle list. So you'll get some duty officers. So, you know, that's always fun to play the duty officer mini game missions. Some a rare console, some cryptic points, and a batleth. So it's going to be some fun, you know, activities, and you get some good prizes if you win. So just head on over there to Kronos, the first city, and make your way over to the batleth arena, you know, interior map. And we're going to have referees. We're going to have, it might even be live streamed. I think I remember hearing talk that they're going to live stream it on I think it might be on Cerberus Films. We'll have to check in on that. But yeah, stay tuned to Trek Radio. We're going to be talking about it. And I know that, you know, it's going to be covered on Holosuite Magazine. There's a links on that, holosuitemagazine.com. I'm sure we're going to be talking about it eventually on Gates of Stovacor when our site comes back up. But there is a forum thread, so I'll put that link into the chat room. If you want to sign up for it, you know, you can put your at handle name in that thread, get more information about it. And if you want to just, you know, come watch, you know, you won't really be able to actually see the fight, because what we're going to have to do is the two people, we're going to, you know, set up a match, and the referees will join in, and then it'll start a PvP map. So those people will, like, you know, load into a PvP instance. They'll fight it out. Then when that's over, they'll leave that and reappear back on the Kronos map. And, you know, at that point, we'll, you know, the winner will advance and the other person is eliminated. Because we don't have open PvP zones, you know. It's not like we could just go to Kronos or Earth Space Dock and just start fighting it out, you know. And kind of like WoW and other games, you could just, you know, put a duel to somebody, and it kind of puts a flag down, and people just fight it out in the middle of the town. The Star Trek Online doesn't do that, so we'll have to load up a PvP zone. But for the most part... yeah, right. So it's just going to be fun. And then I think at the end... Once it's over, I think that's where everybody will probably load up and just, you know, go crazy in a battle royal and, you know, hit everybody with our pain sticks and batleths, and it'll be a good time.
Right.
Gotcha.
And I know you're allowed to play, like, anyone from the Klingon faction, right? Not just Klingons, so you can be your own.
Yeah,
alive.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's okay. Just KDF. And also, just a quick side note reminder is, at any time throughout the Klingon Awareness Week, and especially for this event, to get more information about it and to chat along with it, you know, you could definitely be part of a TrekRadio.net in-game chat channel, but you also want to join the KDF Assistance channel in-game. So you would type a /channel_join and then a space, and it's just KDF Assistance, all one word together. That'd be KDF Assistance, KDF Assistance. And, you know, they're going to be talking about who wins, who's up next, you know, just talking about as it goes on. So that'll be fun. I'm going to definitely, after this show, I'm going to hop on the game and warp on over to Kronos and try to be a part of it.
Yep, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern is when the tournament is taking place.
Excellent plan.
So I heard that you want a Romulan Awareness Week, Warren.
That is a thing. I thought it was interesting that we had, like... Well, I thought it was interesting because I was hearing Klingon Awareness Week, and I was like, I think Klingons are the people that anyone outside of Star Trek Online is most aware of as far as Star Trek. Like, if you say Star Trek, Klingon's, like, one of the first things that comes to anyone's mind. And I understand that the reason why... they do this is that the Star Trek Online, the Klingon faction, is underdeveloped.
Yes, but it is missing a good chunk of content.
But it occurred to me that there is no Romulan faction.
There isn't.
And as I understand it, the only way to be a Romulan...
Not playable, anyway.
As I understand it, the only way to be a Romulan in Star Trek Online is to either make a Vulcan and say it's a Romulan, or you can use the Alien Builder, I think, and try to make your best-looking Romulan.
Yeah, I don't know if you've heard Havrahad.
I've heard.
Complain about this, where there's no actual Romulan ridges in the alien crater yet.
Yeah, whatever. I don't understand those ridges anyway. The ridges never made sense.
Pronounced brow.
Well, if I remember right, that's in the Foundry. I think there is the Romulan ridges for the game, Alien Creator, in the game, like, to be a playable character. But I think, maybe I may be wrong about this, but I thought that that they were talking about there's no Romulan ridges for the NPCs that you create in the Foundry. But they definitely need to add a lot to the Foundry. A lot of assets that are already in-game are not available to the Foundry yet. And so there's a big, you know, push and an outcry, which is, you know, valid. Anything that's available in the game already should be available to the Foundry authors to add it to a mission, you know. There's maps and ships and
Foundry
all this stuff.
I want more stuff.
Yep.
All right, but so I just thought it would be cool to have... I mean, it would be kind of hard to do because there's, like, obviously Klingon Awareness Week is being celebrated with all these in-game events. It'd be hard to do that with a Romulan Awareness Week because there's no Romulan faction to celebrate.
Indeed. So, but what else we got?
But all right, one of the big things I wanted to talk about as far as Klingons go is this is something that I think you just didn't really talk about too much last time.
What's that?
Is I really wanted to talk about the Klingon military.
Yes.
Because
the Shogunate.
Well, sort of.
The Klingon Defense Force.
Well, kind of, maybe. All right, so here's the thing. So you got the KDF, right? And
yeah.
That's the big fleet that we see. It's referred to a couple of times in Deep Space Nine as the KDF, as the Klingon Defense Force. And it's the big old fleet that is seen making war on Cardassia and the Dominion. So, you know, that's cool. But it's also very heavily indicated that, like... that each house has its own armed forces and its own ships. And we know that from, like, the House of Quark, I'm losing my train of thought. We know that from the House of Quark and from when Kern is stripped of his dishonor. We know that... stripped of his dishonor. God, I cannot keep a straight thought in my head.
You are no longer dishonorable. You have to be honorable now.
He's stripped of his honor. He also mentions that that the House of Moog was stripped of its ships, and so we know that each house has its own forces. So it's just kind of weird that, like, it doesn't really explain how those two things work together. Like, is the KDF just a combination of the different armed forces of each house, or
Keep going.
And like, if that's the case, like, are all the members of each ship's crew made up of people loyal to the same house? Because that's not what it looked like when we saw Martok's ship. Like, everyone there was from different, like, you know, everyone there was from different, like, different houses and from all over the Empire. Maybe that was, like, an extreme of war. But it's hard to get a bunch of different feuding factions to unite together to have a big military. Like, Japan didn't really have a military as a country until the Tokugawa shogunate crushed everyone.
Yeah.
And then was like, you know, we have the Tokugawa military is now the Japanese military.
Right.
But before that, there was no Japanese military. There was the Minamono military and the, the other guys. I don't remember, but there were the other guys who had different, each clan had its own military. And it gets kind of, like, that whole thing gets kind of weird. Especially when you're dealing with something as complex and weird as spaceships. So
yeah. Well, like, I do kind of have... I can address that. In a way, it's kind of both, which kind of makes it seem like even more muddy. And like Juanita is saying in the chat room, it's a feudal society where the Chancellor can call upon the great houses to defend the empire. Well, that's definitely a part of it. And another word for the great houses, or another way that they're addressed, is the noble houses. And those are basically the houses that represent, you know, the High Council. So there's the Chancellor. He's like, you know, the main ruler, the main, you know, decision maker type of thing. But then there is the High Council. And the High Council is traditionally made up of the noble houses. And in some canon, I mean, in some soft canon and other references, the noble houses are called noble because they're supposed to have some kind of lineage or heritage ties back to Kaelas and, you know, back to those days. But then we've seen how Martok, you know, rose from a commoner to the Chancellor. And, you know, the House of Moog may not be a noble house, but they might, you know, through their actions, through their exploits, and, you know, being respected, they become a great house. So, you know, you could be either a noble house or a great house, but, you know, that, you know, on the same level type of thing. So those houses would definitely have their own military, their own, you know, people that are loyal to them. So it kind of like, if you look at you know, references to TNG to make it more easily understandable, you had the House of Moog, who was on the High Council, and then you had the House of Duras, who was on the High Council. So there would definitely be Klingons that were loyal to the House of Duras. I mean, obviously, the Duras family. But then there might be, you know, people that are not of the actual bloodline of the House of Duras, but they're loyal to that house. So they might be enlisted in the Klingon military, the Klingon Defense Force, and then still be loyal to the House of Duras, to where if there was, a civil war, you know that those people would go to the House of Duras. And, you know, that's where we saw, to some degree, with Gowron coming to power, it started a Klingon civil war, and Kern said that he had, like, you know, so many squads that were loyal to him, and so that's, he was able to pledge those to the side of Gowron. So it's kind of a little bit of both, where it's like there's definitely an official military, the Klingon Defense Force, and that would be the High Council, and the Chancellor would be like the generals and the higher-ups, you know, executive, chief of office, whatever. What's the president called when it's in terms of the military? Like the commander-in-chief. So it'd be kind of like that, where the High Council and the Chancellor would give orders, you know, and it would trickle down the chain of command, you know, like to the generals and all that, to the captains. So they could definitely, you know, order the Klingon Defense Force ships to go off and, you know, do these campaigns or do these, you know, attacks or that type of thing. But then, if it's like the House of Duras having official, like, military officers in the official army, military, but they're still loyal to Duras, if that noble house on the High Council said, well, everybody else wants to go, like, you know, fight the Cardassians, well, we don't think that's a good idea. The House of Duras doesn't agree, so, you know, I'm not going to commit my forces to that because I think it's either stupid or dishonorable, or, you know, it's too soon, or, you know, we should do something else. That's where you would almost get, like, conscientious objectors or whatever, where, like, those military officers who are loyal to the House of Duras are saying, well, our, you know, the leader of the House of Duras is saying, don't do this. So what, do we follow our house, you know, leader, or do we follow the general and the chancellor? So that, you know, is one level where, well, it kind of could get muddy.
Really complicated.
Well, see, that's the thing, is that this
it gets even worse, though, because if you look at on the Next Generation and even on DS9, Lursa and Bator, you know, were basically either rogues or privateers, because Duras, for at least for a time, was off the High Council, right? Or, you know, they were dishonored. And so when Lursa and Bator were basically brought down the Enterprise, they weren't officially...
Lursa and Bator bring down the Enterprise?
Generations.
I guess technically they did.
It looked to me like they shot it, and then it blew up to me.
Yeah, but they were dead already by then. So.
From the grave, you know.
Okay. So, sorry.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Right. Well, they.
I thought we were talking about something that happened in the series.
they inflicted the killing blow, and then, you know, the person died afterwards. But basically, and then there's also the, I started rewatching DS9 again, and they're in the, like, the second or third episode of Deep Space Nine, the Duras sisters appear on the station, and at that point, like, they're saying, I think it was like Sisko talking to the crew, and they're like, even the Klingon military has put like a warrant out for the Duras sisters that they were, you know, gone rogue or gone renegade, and that they're operating on their own. And so when we see, like, later on in Generations, when we see that they have a bird of prey and they're going after the Enterprise, that would basically be like the House of Duras having their own ship. You know, like, each house can have its own, you know, fleet or its own couple ships, kind of like, you know, well, you know, you probably have a car, you might have a car and a motorcycle and a boat, you know, each house, especially the higher the house gets in status and holdings and everything, they could get, like, you know, multiple ships, where I could kind of see a situation where it's a fledgling house and they're trying to make a name for them and the broader, you know, a community of, you know, being, well, someday we'll get on the High Council, but we only have one ship right now, you know, we only have so much land, so we're trying to expand, whereas a noble house or a rich house might have multiple ships. So when Lursa and Bator are going after the Enterprise, they're basically operating on their own. Like, that's not officially sanctioned by the Klingon Defense Force or the High Council. So it even gets even muddier, where you have official military officers who are loyal to the military, like, or to the government or to the country, but then they'd also be, you know, loyal to an individual house. But then you would have these, you know, rogues or renegades or privateers who have their own ships that go out and do things, and that's not, you know, officially sanctioned by the High Council.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. Pardon me.
Having a little trouble with your DNA transformation there.
Yeah, a little bit. Okay, see, here's the whole place where it gets a little weird for me, is that, so what you have, so, and this is partly just a symptom of the show's not about Klingons, so we don't get as much development on them as I would like, but
right,
it certainly seems like what we have is a feudal system where each house, and I think this was already said in the chat room, each house has their own military that, in, you know, in times of threat are called to defend the country. And that's, a lot of countries have had that, and it has worked better or worse in certain situations. You know, didn't work very well in Japan. It worked okay in, you know, in certain parts of Europe. Now, the question is, at that point, why do they treat it so much like a professional national military, if that's the case? Because they do,
well,
and
because
I,
that would, well, exist, though.
But like, it never has. Like, in history, you can't find a, like, there has never been a country, as far as I know, that has ever had a military that at the same, that was at the same time a national military, but at the same time had all of its assets owned by various, like, noble houses that could just pull them at the you know, whatever.
I think
one.
You might be zoomed in too close. I would look at it more like how the Allied forces were structured in World War II. You had Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was in control of all Allied forces. He was the commander of all Allied forces, correct? Now, below him were all the various different commanders from the various nation states, correct?
Sure.
You know, that's how I'm looking at how the military is structured in the Klingon Empire. Is you have the chancellor, who would in this case be Eisenhower, and then you have the generals or councilmen or whoever who have their own holdings be, you know, in charge of more or less these quote-unquote Klingon nation states.
I mean, kind of, but like,
well, it would,
you know, and then the main interface for, like, the Federation, like, let's go to the Dominion War. The main interface for the Federation forces to the Klingon forces was Bartok, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's the Eisenhower in that case for the Klingon Empire. That's kind of how I'm seeing it unfold.
And it, another word for the Klingon house would basically be a clan. So it kind of, in that regard, is similar to, like, the Japanese clan system where, you know, two clans would be warring, but then at some point, you know, they make peace or whatever, and so each clan would have, you know, its own militia or its own, you know, warriors, soldiers that are loyal to that house. And so, you know, if the head of that clan says, go attack this village over there, they're going to go do what their clan leader tells them. But then if that clan leader says, well, I pledge my troops to go fight in, you know, on behalf of, you know, the emperor, the troops then are just going to follow what that clan leader says. And so it's kind of like, it, and it is unique. That's like just like the what kind of government is the Klingon, where it's definitely overall an oligarchy, but then it has aspects of other things. It is tricky the way they've depicted, and I'm even extending it to some of the books, you know, some of the soft canon that tries to flesh it out, where there is an official army, and for the most part, as long as like all the noble houses are agreeing with each other and everybody likes the chancellor, then it's all fine. You know, the chancellor makes the decisions. But if it becomes like, you know, the House of Duras versus the House of Moog, or, you know, the whole council wants to go left, but this one noble house wants to go right, that noble house is going to say, well, I ain't going to send my troops left when I want to go right, because, you know, I think I don't want my guys to get killed, but then I think, you know, it's better to go this other way. That's where it could start those, you know, loyalty questions of like, and that's even been seen on individual ships where it's like, you know, especially in the IKS Gorkon novel series, it shows, it talks about how on a single ship, there's people, like most of the crew, the troops are loyal to the captain. But if there's like transfers from another ship that get transferred over and they're thinking, this guy's weirdo, you know, he don't know what honor is. He's sending us off in a crazy direction on a wild goose chase. I ain't going to, you know, fight for this ship and that captain. And that's where you would get even infighting or bickering. And that's where it would call, you know, call upon that tradition of like, well, if you don't think the captain is honorable, go challenge him and try to take his command, you know, and if you win, you become the captain. Where it's like, every step of the way with the Klingons, it's kind of like there's the loyalty to the Empire, but then there's the personal, you know, loyalties or loyalty to your house. So it becomes tricky where, you know, one house, especially if it's a noble house or a well-off house, like rich and, you know, land-owning and a lot of resources, they're going to have, you know, people that are loyal to that house first. And then, you know, okay, yeah, we'll go do what the chancellor says as long as it is good for us. But as soon as it becomes not good for us.
I feel like I'm not
making
the point very well. So let's just move on. I don't think I'm okay. I don't think I properly explained what I meant. So I'm done trying to talk about this. Let's talk about something. Let's talk about the TOS TNG retcon or change, if you depend. It's not maybe not necessarily a retcon. But like the difference between the TOS Klingons and when they showed up later with lobsters on their heads.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, because like I mean, that was kind of interesting, and you guys have touched on that a little bit, but this was something that
we don't talk about it with outsiders. Oh wait.
Go ahead,
we don't talk about that with outsiders.
Yeah, that's true. I liked how in DS9 they explained that with an in-joke, but in Enterprise they needed a biovirus.
Yeah.
Like, although to be fair, that's not a bad episode of Enterprise, all told. You know, it's I've seen worse, so I'm okay with that one.
You mean you want to talk specifically about that? Because I was thinking more about just how they're portrayed in TOS versus what they are in TNG.
Oh yeah, definitely. I'm not really interested in the mechanics of why they look different.
I hope not. That'd be
right.
A boring
comment. There have been shifts in how they're portrayed, not just physically, but you know, mental, like, and their attitude and their approach, and you know. From an individual level all the way up to, like, you know, the military, the Empire, and, you know, that whole thing. So, yeah, there has definitely been an evolution, if you want to put it that way, from, you know, the TOS to the movies all the way up to, you know, TNG. And then DS9 really helped to flesh out the Klingon. So it's been, on one level, it's kind of been a constant evolution or, you know, expanding the portrayal of it. And sometimes it's contradictory. You know, sometimes they want to take it in a direction that, oh, this is cool, but then it, you know, well, wait a minute, you're contradicting what, you know, came from the previous season or previous series, I mean.
Well, I mean, and a lot of it, I think we mentioned this briefly back in, or maybe not briefly, it's been a while, back in episode 26 when we were talking about Klingons, because it was like, Gene Roddenberry, as I understand it, he wanted to have Klingons that weren't just, like, mustache-twirling Soviet parallels. He wanted them to be, like, more sympathetic and more interesting, so he made them, like, have this honor code. And then that kind of got... Sometimes that got a little out of hand. Sometimes they would be kind of almost caricatures of themselves.
Did we see a whole lot expressed about the honor code in TOS?
Yeah. I mean, Worf was all about it.
Well, Worf was... But I'm talking about TOS.
There's only one episode I can think of that perhaps has that in there, and even then, in a very indirect way, was Day of the Dove.
Well, that's exactly what I'm talking about. is that in TOS, the Klingons were mustache twirling Soviet parallels, and in TNG, they were in TNG, Roddenberry wanted to make them more interesting, so he gave them this honor code, and then it kind of grew from there.
Uh-huh.
And I thought that was an interesting changeover from, and like, I think it sort of reflected how Star Trek was having to change with the times. Because originally, when we went out into space, like, humans were perfect, and aliens were just dark reflections of the bad things that existed in ourselves. You know?
Right, because it was a vehicle for social, messaging.
Right. But
of it was black and white. Like, you're either good or you're either evil. Like, it wasn't a lot of shades of gray, or like the sympathetic villains. Like, you're the bad guy and you're just bad. It's kind of one dimensional.
Except for Day of the Dove. That's why I love Day of the Dove so much, because it shows Klingons who aren't evil, not necessarily good, but not evil.
Klingons are people too.
and in fact, the Klingons are people too. As goofy as that sounds, is in fact exactly what I think motivated the change, and what motivates part of the change, it's the shift in Star Trek as a whole away from the humans are perfect sort of thing going on. Because, like, the creators of the show realized that just having an entire alien race whose only purpose is to demonstrate a, like, negative aspect of humanity makes the show look kind of racist. Like, you're saying, well, all of this one race is the same. They all have this negative trait. And it's like, that's not good. You don't want that.
Uh-huh.
Somehow we managed to still do it with the Ferengi. But that's a whole nother.
Even at the end of DS9, they're going through changes.
Yeah.
To make them, quote-unquote better, even though in Star Trek Online they're still very much portrayed like, ha-ha, the prophet!
Right.
It's very much what you get from the Ferengi in Star Trek Online. That's what I get anyway. Mm-hmm.
But I think that was an interesting, even though I do feel like the honor warrior is like a different.
That's part of the point of the discussion, Juanita, is that Klingons are not all the same.
Yeah, sorry, maybe I misspoke, but I just want to clarify. I'm not saying all Klingons are the same. I'm saying that in TOS, except for Day of the Dove, all Klingons were evil.
Right.
And yeah, just one-dimensional villain. That all Klingons were evil. And that was how Star Trek did aliens in TOS, was that alien races were just, they were the reflections of our negative traits. And so they were basically just, a group of bad guys.
Yep.
Or
you could recognize them for being the bad guys because they were, not the good guys.
Right.
They weren't Kirk, Spock, McCoy.
But then as the show moved forward, they realized they had to give these species more dimension than they had previously. Yeah.
Another aspect of that is when it's like saying you're just the villain, and it's one dimensional on that level. That the other aspect of it is that would be the same for the whole collective group of them. Like if in the old series, if you saw a Klingon, exactly what they're going to be because all Klingons are the same. Like they're all like that. And I think adding the honor code gave them more like culture, made them more of a fleshed out thing, but it also kind of implies that, there's the honor code and Klingons are going to follow that honor code, but then by the very nature of that shows that, some Klingons are not going to follow it, or some Klingons are going to break, fail to live up to that honor code. So it just gives, the opportunity for more of a diverse personality for Klingons. And it's kind of like, there's a quote that I always like where Jadzia on DS9 said, Klingons are as diverse a people as any. So it's, it's not just going to be like, oh, there's a human, exactly how they're going to act. There's all kinds of different, personalities and types and viewpoints and outlooks of life from humans. So that's kind of the similar thing of like, and it did get the same with the Ferengi. Like, if you saw one Ferengi, you would know, oh, he's just going to act like every other Ferengi we've ever seen, up until a point where they started, changing it, where some people didn't like the fact that, the way their culture was portrayed. So it just kind of give more freedom to have individual characters play against type kind of thing, or it's like it's not just the quintessential or the stereotypical Klingon or Ferengi. This character might, you know, be opposite of that, or might have a take it in a different direction.
Yeah, and that's why I really like the episodes of Klingons that are not warriors. Like, pretty much every time they've introduced a Klingon who wasn't a warrior, except Alexander. I hate Alexander, can't stand him. except Alexander, every time they've introduced a Klingon who wasn't a warrior, I have loved them. Because they have been so cool and interesting, and it shows that they're not all the same. And they're just like, hey guys, we are different, and we have our own, like, weird, unique eccentricities, and we have our own thing going on, we're not all warriors. Because that was part of the problem, was that the warrior code was supposed to make them more sympathetic, but then it kind of swung in the other direction, where suddenly they were all honorable warriors.
Right.
Kind of like Spartan society, right?
And like the first non-warrior Klingon we saw was Kalar, and she had to have the excuse of being half-human. And then like they were like, no, okay, Klingon society can't function with just warriors. Someone has to build the ships, right? You know, these aren't like horses. They don't roam wild on the steps of Kronos. Although we've hatched a couple of conspiracy theories on this side of All Things Trek that Klingon ships are actually just, in fact, large birds that they, like, live inside, and, you know, and, like, the, and that's, because otherwise, there's a couple of, what, don't look at me like that, Bob.
What, like, a big Gomtu? Remember Gomtu?
Yeah, kind of. It's not a serious theory, but it's just, because there are certain episodes of Star Trek that make it seem like there is no one around on Kronos who could possibly build a ship. Of course, those are the bad ones. The good ones we know better. but, like, and I really, you know, I really want to see more of Klingon culture. Personally, I would love a show that was set, you know, in Klingon space or on a Klingon ship, assuming that they got some good writers, because it could so easily be terrible. But if they got good writers, especially if they got, oh man, if they got Ron Moore loves Klingons.
Mr. Klingon.
Yeah.
Yeah, he does.
Mr. Klingon. He became known as Mr. Klingon for writing most of the good episodes. Yeah, he was. They definitely, you know, TNG. Well, actually, the Klingons were created by Gene L. Coon, technically, and he was the writer for the first episode. But then, you know, other writers have taken their stab at the Klingons, you know, pun intended. But then for Ronald Moore, he really fleshed out a lot of the cultural aspects, where it kind of became, you know, if it was just a Klingon extra or ancillary character, then it could have been anybody. But when they wanted to have an episode that really, like, fleshed out or delved into Klingon culture, mythology, all that, it went to Ronald Moore, so he became known as Mr. Klingon.
Well, that makes sense to me. So on a side note, speaking of
Klingon, Ron Moore.
Bite you. Speaking of Klingons that I like, here's a question. So, about Star Trek Online. So in the Star Trek Online universe, Jem'Pok killed Martok because he's a horrible person who will burn in whatever the bad place of Stovogor is.
Actually a point of Star Trek Online lore that I'm not actually all that familiar with. I know it happened, but I don't know why.
In the book, it doesn't even say why. It just says he killed Martok in a duel. It doesn't explain, like, I don't know. I was always under the impression that you're only allowed to challenge the Chancellor to a duel if he's being an idiot. Like, you know, like, there's an etiquette to dual challenging. Like, it's not like you can just run around, because my friend Jim likes to make fun of Klingons and just say that as long as you're stronger, you can win, and, like, you know, the person who leads is going to be the best, like, knife fighter as opposed to the best leader. And I was always under the impression it's a little more complicated than that, and they make that pretty clear in, what's the episode where Dax is talking about the rules of etiquette and challenging for command of a ship? I think it's the one it's the first one with Rotaran. I can't remember the name of it.
Yeah, I know which one you're talking about. I just can't remember the episode title right now.
Right. But in that, yeah, they
I know
make
which
pretty,
one you're talking about.
They make it pretty clear that if you're just some hot, brash young guy who thinks he's cool and challenges the older, experienced, badass leader to a fight, like, even if you could maybe beat him because you're younger and stronger, if he's a really cool dude, they won't.
I don't know. There's a line I remember quite distinctly that my dad telling me quite a bit, is that youth and agility will always be beat out by old age and treachery.
Yeah, but not in a straight up fight they won't.
Well, I think that's part of his point.
If you kick their cane out from under there. But it's kind of different, because on a starship, it's been established that on a starship there is that like pecking order or hierarchy. And because, you know, it's been established, oh, if you don't think the captain is honorable or if you think he's off his rocker or whatever, you could challenge him and you become the captain. Well, technically, it's the first officer who can do that. So if there's a junior officer, you know, like a ensign or even a commander, a lieutenant, they can't just go to the captain and say, I think, you know, I want your ship, I want your command, I challenge you.
I want your ship. Fight!
You have a chair,
I like your chair. I have to stand over here. This is dumb. I want a chair.
You got the best quarters in the ship. But so they have to go up the pecking order. So it's like if there's a junior officer that wants to, you know, thinks the command, the captain is, you know, should be replaced, he has to challenge his direct superior and then go up the line that way. So it's like, you know, it's the first officer that would challenge the captain, and then the second officer would have to challenge the first officer and go up the line that way. So, but that's on a starship. And I kind of think that Juanita is getting close to it, where it's like for the High Council, you kind of have to be a player. You know, you can't just be some random Klingon that walks in off the street and says, I want to be Chancellor, I'm going to challenge you. They would just throw you out. But if it's like one of those noble houses, or if it's like somebody who's like, you know, in the court, so to speak, you know, whether it's a vice president or a cabinet member, a senator or something, like you have to be in that kind of arena to begin with to think, well, a position of power and authority and political influence to be able to do that. But that scenario with Jim'Pok and Martok was touched on in the Path to 2409 that was on the website. And it was very shady. It's like, I'd have to read it again to get the exact wording, but basically it's like, you know, they're having disagreements, there's like big arguments or debates going on in the council or whatever, and then at one point Martok is in a room, like goes to his chambers, Jim'Pok goes into that room and then comes out and Martok is dead. And he's like, I'm the Chancellor, I killed Martok. Well, that's just really fishy, you know. You never really know what happened behind closed doors. Well, that's like why, if he's not a changeling, a lot of people think, or I mean, 8472, like some people just like the idea of it, or, you know, the way things went down and some of the decisions that Jim'Pok made after that point, they're like, that don't seem right. It seems like, you know, kind of like when Gowron was replaced by a changeling, like, there's something fishy here. Some people think he was either a changeling or an Undyne. But even if that's not the case, the way it went down would kind of call to mind, like, the Duras family and how they would, like, you know, do shady business to try to, you know, poison a person or, you know, get them in a different way than the established, you know. It just didn't seem right. So a lot of people, you know, aren't really happy with Jim'Pok and the way that went down. And, you know, but I do think that deserves to have, like, at least a comic book, a novel. I mean, that has a lot to you know, to flesh out there. That's why I was thinking, kind of going back to the Needs of the Many book, I liked it. You know, I liked the idea of novels, not just based on Star Trek, but based on the Star Trek Online universe. And once I finished it, I was like, okay, that was cool, but, you know, where's the next one? Or what? There's so many unanswered questions that I would have wanted, like, you know, the Klingon story with the Gorn and the Orion and that whole, you know, war that went down. And then, you know, there's the Romulan story that they could tell. So there's definitely more books that could be, you know, told or written to tell stories of that gap, you know, before Star Trek Online, because you don't want it just a novel based on the missions that we're already playing, but, you know, that whole timeline before the 2409.
I think it was for maybe Kestrel was in a corner. I think is more likely what happened, especially since we know that Cryptic either is timid to do so, or they don't want to shell out the money for getting the likenesses of a lot of the actors.
Yeah.
You know, maybe they didn't want to deal with trying to get J.G. Fertzler's, you know, likeness for Martok, maybe is what it is.
Well, so that's part of it.
So, like, but here's, okay, so here, the thing about this that weirds me out is that I was always sort of under the impression that there was some kind of repercussion if you were just a jerk and, like, you know, walked up and in defiance of all etiquette stabbed somebody to get their position. And, like, the Empire was going pretty good under Martok, as I understood it. And so it just, I don't know. Also, my other question is, can I make a Foundry mission where I go back in time and save Martok? Because the future needs him, because he is a great man.
As long as you don't have Martok as he looked in the show.
So no, then.
Well, but then again, I think you might run into trouble with, by saying it's Martok, because I think part of the like the ULA or whatever that is, I think part of the stipulations is you can't use canon established right. characters. Like, you can't just say, I'm going to go involve Kirk or Spock in my mission, or it's like, you know, and not just to say, you know, they don't want what you're going to do with it. I think partly for licensing, partly, you know, for likeness, but they just don't want people, you know, trying to rewrite episodes or, you know, that type of thing. So some Foundry authors try to, like, walk that line and go right up to it, and some have kind of crossed it to some degree. But I think that's, you know, you might get it into it. Not trouble so much, but they might either tell you to change it or delete it, because I think we're not. And that, I think that also applies to characters from the game. So it's not just like Kirk and Spock and, you know,
right.
Picard, but even, like, you know, to some degree,
Jempok.
Like Admiral, Jempok or Admiral, what's his face? You know, the Federation guy.
That's how much Wikipedia player David is. He's Admiral the Quinn. Name of the main NPC for the Fed side.
Wait, hang on. His name is Admiral Quinn?
His name is Admiral Quinn. All right, it's not the Admiral Quinn that we know and love from TNG. This is Admiral Quinn, a Trill.
All right, well, let me tell you something. He's not an Undyne. You know how I know? Because in like following the basic rules of Star Trek, like, soft canon things that I've seen, anyone whose name starts with Q is Q. So he's Q. That's my new theory.
That is an interesting idea.
I mean, I don't actually think it is. I just noticed that's a thing. Is that there have been a disturbing number of characters who the Q. Oh God, there's no way to say this without sounding like a terrible pun. But the Q that they are a Q is that their letter starts with Q. Or their name starts with Q. Excuse me.
That's a lot of QQ.
Yeah. There
Zing.
Is. Oh my God. All right. So I think that's about all we have time for, isn't it?
It is. We're coming up to the top of the hour here, where the Batleth tournament's going to start.
Yep. Enjoy the Batleth tournament.
That's right. We also got Phenomenal Phelpster coming up at the top of the hour here, assuming he's around. He's around, right? Are you around,
yep. Phelpster?
Cool. Sweet. He's there and around. All right. So I think that's been all things Trek for today.
All right. Next week, because I meant to do this week, but then Star Trek on then Klingon Awareness Week happened. Next week, I'm going to lay out
a wild Klingon Awareness Week comes from the underbrush.
next week, I'm going to lay out the things I didn't like about Enterprise and how I think it could have been really awesome if it had been just a little different. Because I don't think I've ever done an episode like that. So it's happening.
All right. I can see that.
All right.
So if you'd like to go ahead and get in touch with the show, you can go ahead and email us at allthingstrek@hotmail.com. We've also got a Twitter at allthingstrek, and you can join us next week at 1 p.m. in the West, 4 p.m. in the East, other times, other places. This has been Bob.
And Oren.
And David. Thank you, David, so much for providing engineering once again for us.
Kapla.
So what are we getting played out with, David?
I think we're going to go with the brand new song from The Guild. If you've heard that, I love it. If you haven't, it's going to be a new song, so check it out.
Thank you for listening to All Things Trek. This show is distributed under a Creative Commons 3.0 license, which means please share it, but don't change it or sell it. Remember, resistance is futile.